All right, so I want to tell you about a result which I think is, well, it could be cast in different languages, but I think it's most illuminating if we think about it in terms of a communication problem, where the setup is as follows. We give Alice essentially unlimited powers. Alice, you can think of in your mind as her occupying perhaps a very large sphere, sort of in the center of the world, and you can make that as large as you want. You can give her as much time and energy and everything, resources that you want. Ultimately, what we really mean by this is that Alice gets to control the global quantum state at some later time. She can send signals out and prepare a state any way she likes. In practice, what she's going to do is she's going to send some signal out to Bob, who occupies an even larger sphere. And what we assume about Bob is important. Bob does have some restrictions. So Bob has no restrictions on his size, or you can think of a very large sphere or an infinite transverse plane that's occupied by detectors that Bob controls. But these detectors are going to be on only for a time delta t. And so they are going to probe a spatial region, in other words, that's of size delta t in units where the speed of light is 1. And we are going to assume something about the average energy of the signal that Bob receives during this time. So those are going to be the restrictions. Ultimately, they all come from Bob's limitations. What we care about is what kind of energy arrives here and how much time Bob has to examine the signal. Okay. we're going to use curly n for the number of different messages that Alice is going to pick from. And so the information content, in some sense, of what Alice is sending out is log n. It's one out of those n messages that she chooses. The question is whether Bob is actually going to learn that much. Is he going to receive that much information? And that's kind of the setup. Are there any questions about the setup? Maybe there will be later when this becomes more concrete, and please just interrupt me and ask. One more thing I should say is that we don't even really care whether gravity is weak where Alice is or in the interior of the space-time. The only thing that's going to matter is that gravity is weak where Bob is, which in an asymptotically flat space-time will be the case if we take the radius of Bob's sphere large enough. So here's naively what we would expect. With no restriction on the size of the emitter and the receiver, if we didn't really impose any restrictions on Bob, then clearly there's no limit to how many different signals Bob can distinguish and Alice can choose from. And a really primitive and not very efficient way of sending information, but one which I think will be illuminating for what follows, is where I imagine that Alice has literally tiled her sphere with laser guns or light bulbs of some sort, and she simply has n different, you know, positions on, you know, n different solid angles that she can shoot one particular classical signal out into. Okay, and she chooses just one out of those, and she fires it, and Bob has a lot of detectors on his sphere, and then depending on at which solid angle does he receive a flash of light, that tells him which of the n messages Alice wanted to send. And of course, they agreed beforehand which flash means what, you know, the weather's nice, and so on. Yeah.
What are the constraints or assumptions about the Hamiltonian that propagates degrees of freedom between Alice and Bob? Gravity around Bob, but what else? Some locality or something has to be assumed.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm assuming local relativistic quantum field theory.
Free theory?
No.
Okay.
No, not free theory. So so this is an assumption. I mean, that is definitely an important assumption. But it's the key point here is that I'm not assuming any particular method of communication. There's no particular channel that's, you know, physically realized in this or that way. So long as the laws of quantum field theory are obeyed, these results should hold. And in the particular way that I've just tried to encode a message, what would be the limit on the number of different messages that Alice can send? Well, I just told you there is no limit, but one way that we could think about that is to say, well, if Alice's sphere has some finite radius Ra, there's only so many different angular positions I can distinguish consistent with quantum mechanics. Okay, I have, you know, the pixels can't be too small, their density can't be too high. Roughly the number of pixels is the area divided by you know, some length scale that's given by h bar over the energy squared. Okay. And the point is that, of course, we get to make Ra as large as we like, and it's for that reason that even with our primitive encoding scheme, there is no limit to how many different messages Alice can send out. A different question, of course, is how many different messages can Bob actually distinguish? Okay. And here's where recent entropy bounds that we found that apply in the weak gravity regime that you get to in asymptotic regions of asymptotically flat space, those entropy bounds impose what are, to me at least, somewhat surprisingly strong limitations on how many different states Bob can actually distinguish. They tell you that the amount of information that Bob can receive is literally just limited by the energy times the time. So energy, again, is the average energy of the signal that gets sent by Alice. So it's, you know, again, you can just define an average density operator for all the different signals that Alice can send and then compute the expectation value of the energy. And delta T is the time for which Bob's detectors are on. And this looks like a fairly standard kind of expression. We see it all the time, you know, energy time uncertainty principle. But it's actually very surprising in this setting that this should limit the number of different states that Bob can distinguish because, again, Bob has access to the, sort of an arbitrarily large system in the transverse direction or an arbitrarily large sphere. What on earth would stop Bob from distinguishing, you know, at which angle or at which transverse position, if we use planes, a signal is arriving? If these could be classical signals, why can't I make n arbitrarily large just by making the emitting and receiving spheres arbitrarily large? And I can say more about the origin of these bounds, but I'll get through this first, and then you can ask me about it if you want to hear more about that. So the question is why, you know, can we understand this limit? I mean, of course, one possibility is that these bounds are wrong, but actually they've been kind of proven, so they're not wrong. We have to come to a more, I mean, it'd be satisfying to have a more intuitive understanding of what's actually happening here and what is preventing Bob from succeeding in distinguishing all the different things that Alice might send. And again, we seem to be able to dial here a classical regime where E times delta T is enormously large compared to H bar. And still there's a problem simply because this doesn't increase with N. It has no N in it, doesn't know how many different messages there are. And I just argued that I can make N arbitrarily large. So even if we make this classical, there still seems to be some kind of contradiction. So let's see why this is secretly not classical if the message space is very large. That's really the answer. So let's formulate this whole protocol in a sort of standard quantum communication language. And before I do that, I just want to sort of give a heads up. There's an alternative way that you might want to think about this problem, where Bob is simply the detector at LHC or something. The message that is arriving is the output of an S-matrix experiment. And so this tells us something about the information content of this out state. And recently there's been some discussion about how much information there is, for example, in the vacuum. These bounds tell you that there is none. And I'll come back to this at the end. Okay, so here's the quantum restatement of what I just said. Alice prepares some signal state with probability PA. So this big A stands for Alice. The little A stands for, it labels the different messages that Alice might send. For simplicity, you might want to think of PA as just 1 over N. Message has equal probability, but you don't have to. And then there's an average density operator, which, well, is the average of those messages. And again, we allow Alice unlimited access and power. And so we're going to be super generous and just treat row Alice as a global state. She can simply dial the entire global state of space-time. Now, Bob is different. Bob has access to a finite subregion, which is limited by the fact that his detectors are on only for time delta t. And so you can think of that as a shell of width delta t that Bob is probing. And so what Bob has access to is a reduced density operator, rho Bob, which you get by tracing out everything but that shell from the global state. Okay, and this is an example of a quantum channel. It's a very simple example, but if we're going to use this language, this would be the channel that we're considering. And it's its capacity that we are putting a bound on. So Bob will then go ahead and try and decode the message. He's going to try to figure out which of the messages Alice actually sent. And he can do that by trying to be clever and performing some kind of generalized measurement on the arriving signal. This doesn't have to be a projective measurement, hence I'm using these more general measurement operators that just have to sum to 1. And that gives us a conditional probability. So what we really want, of course, is that if Alice sends A, Bob finds A, so we would love for this to be a delta function, I mean a Kronecker delta. But of course, things can go wrong, and so sometimes Bob will find a state B that's not equal to A. And here are the probabilities for those various outcomes. So then we can quantify how well things are going between Alice and Bob in terms of mutual information. I apologize to probably the many people in this room for whom this is insultingly familiar, but maybe people are more interested in quantum gravity. Not everybody sees this all the time. So anyway, here's the mutual information. It's the Shannon entropy. I'm using here the classical mutual information because it's really classical information that's being sent over a quantum panel, right? So it's the Shannon entropy of Alice's probability distribution for the different messages, plus the Shannon entropy of the probability distribution that Bob receives, various different messages, minus the joint entropy of the joint distribution. And it's easy to check that this can't be bigger than log n. Of course, in the optimal case, let's say all the probabilities for the different messages are just equal, and Bob is able to completely distinguish them with certainty, then Bob and Alice would in the end have mutual information log n. That would be the ideal case where no mistakes are made. I think I just said that. So apologies. Here we go. So now what exactly happens depends on how smart Bob is in choosing his measurement operators. But fortunately, there is an independent upper bound that holds true on the mutual information that they can achieve, that holds true no matter how smart Bob is about his measurements, which is called the Holevo quantity, chi, and it's given by this expression. So this is now the von Neumann entropy of the argument. So you look at the von Neumann entropy of the average state that Bob receives minus the averaged von Neumann entropy of the individual states that Bob receives. All right. So one nice thing about this expression is that, you know, you should be worried at this point that we're really talking about density operators in quantum field theory here. And the von Neumann entropy, for example, any one of these things has a UV divergence associated to it that comes from entanglement across the boundary of Bob's shell. And so, you know, we'd have to worry about regulating that in some way. But in fact, you can see that because the probabilities add up to one, and in the ultraviolet, those are the same divergences no matter what the state is, they actually cancel. In this expression, this is already finite. Nevertheless, it'll be convenient to work instead with what are called vacuum subtracted entropies, which is simply, you know, adding and subtracting this expression to both the entropy of the vacuum restricted to Bob's region to both terms here. So we're adding zero, but that way each term individually is already finite. So again, a vacuum subtracted entropy just means you take the entropy of a general quantum state reduced to Bob's shell, which has divergences, and then you also compute the entropy of the vacuum reduced to Bob's shell, which also has some UV divergences, and you subtract the two from each other. That's what I mean by delta S. Okay.
So yeah. If L is prepares the vacuum, let's say if L is just prepares the vacuum, then chi is zero.
If Alice just prepares the vacuum, then pi is zero, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So then nothing is...
So that's not very surprising, right? So then she has only one. Yeah, there are no things that Bob could possibly hope to distinguish in that case. So in that case, the bound is not surprising. I'm obviously here focusing on a setting where the bound does seem surprising. Right, but you're correct. And it's a good thing that we get that answer. Alice prepares the vacuum. I can go into more detail, but intuitively, I think it's kind of clear that if we've chosen the messages to be classical, so Bob is literally receiving like a laser pulse at a particular angle, then the vacuum subtracted entropy, and this is some coherent state, right? The vacuum subtracted entropy of each individual signal that Bob might receive is essentially zero. There's no entropy. Each such state is a very definite state. The thing that's interesting is that this state here, that's the one that we expect should reduce to this entropy here. Sorry, that should reduce to log n. That should be the thing that if all goes well, tells you that ultimately the mutual information can be as large as log n, that Bob can distinguish between n different states. And certainly, if this was rho Alice and not rho Bob, the average density operator for Alice, well, that's just the average of the n different global states corresponding to n different messages. Of course, that entropy is going to be log n. Right? The problem is that this is rho average as seen by Bob in his restricted region. Okay, and that might be less. Okay, so. So let's see how that comes to be. So the positivity. So let me just I'm sort of giving you now a very brief rederivation of these entropy bounds, and not very rigorous, but it's very easy to show. Positivity of the relative entropy is just some standard result in quantum mechanics. It's always true. It's just a mathematical fact. And it's easy to rewrite that positivity as the following statement. That's really the statement I want to use here, so you don't feel so familiar with relative entropy. That's fine. It's the same thing as saying that the vacuum subtracted entropy of some state. So this sigma here, remember, is the vacuum reduced to Bob's region. This rho average B is the average signal state reduced to Bob's region. So the vacuum subtracted entropy of that average signal state is less than or equal to, I put a curly thing here because depending on how you normalize this quantity, there should be some 2 pi's and 8 bars and things like that. But this thing here is supposed to be the vacuum subtracted modular energy of the reduced state. And what is that? Well, it's the expectation value of something called the modular Hamiltonian, for Bob's region. First, you take the expectation value of that operator in the state rho Bob, and then you take it again in the state vacuum in Bob's region, and you take the difference. What's the modular Hamiltonian? Well, it's defined as the thing that, as the operator that if you exponentiate it, you get the vacuum state in Bob's region. So it's just basically the log of the vacuum. This is something that wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for the global vacuum because it's a pure state. There's no good way of taking its log, but for a density operator like this, which essentially has support in all possible states, even if exponentially small, it makes sense to take a log, and you can get this vacuum. You can get this modular Hamiltonian. Intuitively, what you want to think about is the case where the region is not like the one that Bob is exploring, but the region is Rindler space, so half of flat space. In that case, the modular Hamiltonian is just the Rindler Hamiltonian. If you have an object of energy E at some distance, delta X from the Rindler horizon, then that contributes to this Hamiltonian E delta X. Okay, so that's that gives you some notion of what this modular energy is. In general, the modular Hamiltonian is a highly non-local quantity, but fortunately on null surfaces, exact expressions are often known and they're local integrals. Now for a shell of the width that Bob is exploring, it is actually possible to write down an exact expression for the modular Hamiltonian. I'm not going to write it down for you here, but the upshot of it is that it gives you roughly the energy times the time that Bob's detectors are open for. So roughly speaking, that's the statement that if instead of restricting to the semi-infinite region to the right of the Rindler horizon, I had stopped it here and restricted to this finite region, then so long as that region has some size of order delta x and the energy is reasonably well localized to it, then you expect a modular energy of order E delta x. And there are, in fact, order one factors which you can compute, which you need to take into account if you want to be precise about it. But I don't need to do that here because I'm just interested in how things scale with the number of messages. And it's basically a finite versus infinite type of contradiction. So this is work that the precise versions of this expression are found in these papers. This is with my students Ilan Halpern and Jason Keller, and those works are cases where we took entropy bounds that were already known in the weak gravity regime, where you think of turning off G Newton, and then basically noted that versions of these entropy bounds apply even if gravity is strong, so long as you move into the asymptotic region of asymptotically flat space. That's like turning off G Newton. Everything gets diluted there. And so gravity effectively is weak. And this is work with my former student, Zach Fisher, who is now here, and a bunch of other wonderful people. So finally, let's get to the upshot here. We had two inequalities. Let me just go back a little bit to collect the relevant information. What I said back here is we can bound how much information Bob can learn in terms of this whole level quantity pi. The main thing that is going to allow us to make chi large is this vacuum subtracted entropy of the density operator and of the average signal in Bob's region. If we lived in a just happy world, this would be log n. Okay. but in fact, we can bound this quantity in turn. So this is sort of a sequence of inequalities that I'm writing down by the modular energy of this average signal state in Bob's region, and the modular energy in turn is bounded by a quantity that's given by an order one factor times the energy of the signal that Bob is receiving times the amount of time his detectors are on for. Okay, so let's plug that back into this expression. And so now we see that the mutual information is effectively bounded by this modular energy, or in other words, by the average energy times the time interval. I've now just recovered the claim that I made early on, that such an entropy bound exists, and I've converted it into a statement directly about the whole level quantity. So now it's a bound on the channel capacity.
Can you clarify the sense in which you mean classical? Because you certainly don't mean an h bar goes to zero limit.
Yeah. Cool. So I don't mean an h bar goes to zero limit. So what I mean is that the bound to me is most striking if I think of it as classical. So the reason that I'm calling it classical is that it's classical communication. So the different, I'm not considering superpositions of the different signals that Alice might send. She's either going to send one or another or another or another. But the channel is by nature governed by quantum field theory, so it's a quantum channel. And to compute what happens, I have to do things like trace out over everything but Bob's region and then analyze what Bob can still see. But it's classical in the sense that I'm not considering superpositions of signal states.
So the signal states are roughly some sharp wave packets.
I mean, of course we can. The analysis is general enough that you could also consider the possibility that Alice would use really very quantum signals. She could still use a different quantum wave packet and never consider superpositions for each message. But the apparent contradiction is most striking if we think of Alice as sending big classical blobs like, you know, laser pulses. Then this is kind of surprising because you have all this transverse space that she could send them into. So what is happening? Why is this happening to Bob? How do we resolve this apparent paradox? Roughly speaking, so the precise way of I think answering this question is to think again back relative entropy, which entered into the very first step of the derivation of this entropy bound. Relative entropy is really something that tells you how easy it is to distinguish two states from one another. And what's happening is that the relative entropy is going to zero if Bob and Alice are trying to increase their message space to contain too many messages. Why? Well, operating detectors for a finite time delta t introduces a little bit of thermal noise. Normally, that's not something you would worry about if you are sending and receiving classical signals, of course. I mean, this happens all the time. The detectors that, you know, if you have a little detector that sees if you're walking into the room, that, you know, it's operating for a finite time, and it's not bothered by these insanely weak fluctuations that might come from turning the detector on and off like that. So more precisely, when you look at the density operator of the vacuum restricted to Bob, so just nothing is happening, that's already noisy. It's thermal with respect to the modular Hamiltonian for Bob's region. But this is sort of the order of magnitude of the noise. It's that kind of temperature. So in other words, there's a typical wavelength associated to the noise that has to do with the width of Bob's shell. And because there is, there's a small probability. So remember, Bob has this enormous sphere lined with detectors that are designed to, you know, then figure out at which angle is Alice's signal arriving. But some of these detectors might just go off due to a thermal fluctuation. Now again, if this is a classical signal, so that this quantity is very large compared to one, then the probability for that is exponentially small. That's the usual Boltzmann suppression. That's why we don't see an elephant suddenly appearing in this room, even though we are at finite temperature. And so you would normally not worry about this, this probability of a sort of false detection, right? But if we increase the number of messages, well, so long as the number of messages times this probability is much less than one, then roughly the total number, the expected number of false detections is just this product. Once it becomes of order one, then of course we have to do a more sophisticated calculation, but this is good enough to see that if I make the number of possible different signals too large, then I'm going to start having an order one probability eventually for some detector to go off and it wasn't actually a signal. Right? That's because another way of thinking about that is that, you know, the more possible angles Alice is going to shoot the laser into, the more detectors Bob has to actually build and put there and worry about fluctuating. And so the more likely it is that one of them is going to go off. So when log n is much greater than e times delta t over h bar, this becomes greater than 1. And Bob isn't able to tell anymore what the real signal is and what is just a false alarm. And that's why it doesn't work. Okay, so that's the end of this part of the story. It's really the fact that you can overcome a Boltzmann suppression by having an enormous prefactor to the exponential suppression. Right, so in this case, it's the number of possible detectors that could go off that. And it's exactly when you need it to go wrong. So the bound, of course, would have been violated when n becomes greater than e to the e times delta t over h bar. That's when this bound on the mutual information would have been violated. But that's precisely the regime where the protocol doesn't work. So the crossover is in the right place. Any questions? Yeah.
So this bound is due to kind of like the bounds on signal to noise. You know, there's noise due to the reduced state on a subregion in quantum field theory. It's going to be thermal due to the modular Hamiltonian. And then, you know, you can compute how much signal you could put in by the signal to noise ratio. But I heard mentions of gravity. I just don't see where the gravity comes in. It seems just like free QFT to me.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. There's no G Newton in the bound.
Okay.
And I was assuming that gravity is weak where Bob lives. The reason that I need that to be true, the technical reason I need that to be true, is that if gravity was not weak, it wouldn't be clear, for example, what you would mean by the vacuum in the same region, right? If the signal states deformed the geometry in the region where Bob was, then it wouldn't be, you know, several of the things I said would not be well defined. But it is remarkable. So it is a fact that these bounds were found by thinking about quantum gravity, conjecturing semi-classical things about quantum gravity that should hold true, and then taking limits in clever ways so that G Newton would drop out and you'd end up with statements about quantum field theory that were not previously known, which you can then go ahead and try to prove within quantum field theory, given that they only involve H bar. And that's kind of the story that I'm going to try to tell in the colloquium today. I think it's a really fascinating fact that we are discovering new results about what seems naively like non-gravitational physics by thinking about quantum gravity and then kind of going down to quantum field theory. So I think what it really means is that it probably ultimately doesn't make sense to think of quantum field theory as entirely separated from gravity. Great. Any other questions about this?
So if I understand this right, and I might not, you're basically saying, okay, I've got a resonator, I got some error on these, and I declare failure when I get one bit wrong, and the game is over. So what prevents me from just saying, okay, Alice is going to send the same message multiple times because she's aware she can't send it absolutely perfectly.
So then you start doing better, but then of course you have to adjust the E and the delta T that goes into the upper bound because Bob is going to have his detectors on for longer and he's going to receive more energy. So for example, I could simply you know, go from delta t to n time, little n times delta t or something, and you know, Bob would receive four copies or n copies of the message. I shouldn't have called it n, k copies of the message. And then that would clearly improve his odds of decoding the message, but it also raises the upper bound because, in fact, by n squared, by k squared, right? Because both the energy and the time, in my example, would go up by a factor of k. The claim here is, of course, not that they can't communicate at all an arbitrary number of messages, but it's going to cost them more energy than you might naively think, or more time than you might naively.
Does the bound get worse if you assume some particular chaotic property about the theory? Like if you assume that there is a Yapler exponent which is greater than something.
There was no place where I assumed that wasn't the case.
Right.
So I think if you say that does the bound get worse, you mean does the bound get stronger?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
I see. I would call that better. Is what you have in mind that the propagation of the signal from Alice to Bob involves some sort of degeneration into chaos? You don't.
And then even more effort to unscramble it back. Like, is that sort of orthogonal kind of thing that you can add to
that? That's a really good question, and just shooting from the hip, I mean, I haven't specifically... I think that... Well, okay, it depends on whether the scrambling or the chaos that you have in mind is going to... dilute the support of the message over a region that's larger than delta t, right? I mean, if that happens, then of course, trivially, I mean, it just becomes really hard for Bob to see what there is if he's only going to look at some small part of the signal. So long as that doesn't happen, let's say it gets only diluted over the transverse directions, then I think it shouldn't make a difference because... these bounds don't know how complicated the measurement operators are that Bob gets to use. Bob gets to use any measurement operator, no matter how unrealistically computationally powerful. It just has to be restricted to Bob's region. And so you know, that allows him to undo any kind of chaotic evolution. Yeah, Ning?
So I guess one way to answer George's question is using something called the data processing inequality. So the data processing inequality is the statement that if I take the distinguishability of two states and I pass them through some CPTP map that's acting on both states at the same time, that cannot increase the distinguishability of the two states. So because the Halevo quantity can be written as a sum over relative entropies, that means that if I pass them through the CPTP map, the distinguishability will also decrease as long as the CPTP map is not. So that I think.
Yeah, and I think it not being unitary is the case where you would spread it over the longitudinal direction, but it would still be unitary if yeah. That was a great question. Any other questions? I think we have a little time. All right. Good. So then I want to just discuss another apparent contradiction. That involves measuring conserved charges. So here's again a sort of attempt to show that this bound that I just derived doesn't make any sense. And here's what Alice and Bob are doing in this protocol. So here's Alice. She occupies some planet or Death Star or whatever your preferred model is of mass m-naught. And Bob is out here at very large radius r Bob. And Alice can send Bob a signal, seemingly, right? just by reducing the mass of her planet, or we could also use electric charge, of course, any kind of conserved charge that can be measured out on a very distant sphere using Gauss's law or something like that. So in this case of a mass, what we would say Bob can measure is the Bondi mass of the enclosed asymptotically flat spacetime. And so here's the picture, right? So Alice radiates away an enormously large amount of mass, but she chooses how much, precisely how much she radiates away encodes a kind of message. We can just, divide the interval from zero to m naught into a bunch of little intervals, and depending on what the final mass of Alice's planet is, that says a different thing to Bob. Okay. Now Bob sleeps right through all of that radiation and pays no attention to it whatsoever, doesn't measure it, and wakes up the next morning and decides to measure the Bondi mass. And remember here, it was always important that we give Bob only a finite amount of time to do that. But notice that Bob is not receiving any energy whatsoever during the time that he's making this measurement. There's no energy at all coming from Alice to Bob at that time. And so our bound tells us that Bob should not be able to gain any information the next morning. If his detectors were off here and only got turned on there, it should not be possible for Bob to learn anything from Alice by doing a finite time measurement like this. Okay, is that... any questions about this current one? So on the other hand, we all think, we know how to measure the Bondi mass in every GR textbook, but we know how to measure the electric charge. Just integrate radial electric field around the sphere. All right, so I think I just said that, but here's an alternative picture, which is a Penrose diagram. And you can see very nicely the Bondi mass would be kind of defined right out here at future null infinity. It's usually associated with a particular cut of future null infinity. As gravitational radiation arrives, the Bondi mass would decrease as you move that cut up. But we're going to be generous and give Bob a finite time interval to do his measurements. Nevertheless, Bob tells us no radiation's arriving, and so it should not be possible to gain any information. In this case, I'm just going to give it away, the resolution of the paradox is quantum fluctuation. It is actually not possible to measure the Bondi mass in a finite amount of time at arbitrarily large radius. Okay. So the limit that we have taken here, and which is essential for this entropy bound to apply, is that we first specify how much time Bob has to do the measurement, and then we take the limit where his sphere, its radius goes to infinity, holding fixed the amount of time. It's in that limit that you can't measure the Bondi mass. The claim is not that you can't measure it at all. But when we actually measure the masses of objects astronomically, for example, we're always in the regime where the time scale of the measurement is much greater than the radius at which the measurement is effectively done. Like if you watch planets orbiting around some star or something, you determine the mass of the star. That's a regime where you have to watch the planet for a time that's much greater than the light crossing time of the orbit. So here we're in a very different regime, and in that regime you can explicitly calculate the fluctuations of Bondi mass or of the electric charge, and you find that they diverge in this way. So if I fix delta u and then I take r to infinity, this is, you have no idea what the Bondi mass. So this is work with another student, Ben Chandrasekaran, Ilan, and Aaron Wall. Okay, so the final thing that I wanted to say, I'm running a little early, actually. Is this, you guys are not asking enough questions. Final thing I wanted to say is that this has a little bit of relevance to some of the discussion around the black hole information paradox that's recently centered on the BMS symmetries in four dimensions and claims by Hawking and Strominger and Perry and some others that there is a sense in which the vacuum contains an infinite amount of information. There are many reasons why I think that this approach can't help us with the black hole information paradox, but one way one angle that I think is important to sort of illuminate is that if the vacuum contained any information, I think that would be a violation of the equivalence principle. It would mean that you could look at empty space, and in some sense you could figure out which asymptotic coordinate system is being used to describe it. That's precisely what we're not supposed to be able to figure out. There's no measurement that tells us which coordinates are being used. This gives us a different angle on the same question. It tells us, just from the point of view of these entropy bounds, that there is no information in the vacuum because the energy is zero. And so we don't actually have the ability of losing information into the vacuum either in any kind of scattering. The information has been sort of claimed to be in what are called soft gravitons, and then the statement I think depends on whether you talk about strictly zero frequency objects or just very long wavelength objects, much longer than the characteristic timescale of the interactions that are happening. If there are soft gravitons in the latter sense, they have finite duration, then of course we do need to measure them to get all the information out, but it also means that we're not in the vacuum. Those are distinct excitations above the vacuum. These are states which are orthogonal to the vacuum. So then there is information, but we're not in the vacuum. If we're talking about infinite wavelength or zero frequency gravitons or soft photons, those are things which by definition cannot be measured by anybody ever. So no matter how long you measure something, you would never be able to capture this object. And so then there isn't any information in it either, but it's indistinguishable from the vacuum. So I think that these bounds are a useful way of seeing what can and what cannot contain information in the S matrix. So I'm just going to end it there. Thank you. Since we have time, I do want to advertise this limerick to one of my students in my quantum mechanics class who was bored during the exam. So he wrote this.
Any questions?
So I'm wondering whether this really is a contradiction with the claims that Strominger and friends are making. My impression of what they're saying is that the information is really encoded in this kind of memory effect. So it's not that you can sort of look at the vacuum at one time and distinguish different BMS translations of the vacuum or something like that, but rather that if you sort of have an initial coordinate system or something, some set of satellites, and then you allow your signal to pass,
there's a famous tool
through the signal, and he would not get information that way. He'd have to keep his satellites around.
There's a famous two-step, right, where you go back and forth between an untenable point that is just absurd and is a very strong claim, and whenever it's attacked, you retreat to an obviously correct claim. And which sounds superficially similar, right? So there is no question that that the BMS group is important for understanding symmetries in D equals 4. It is a complication that arises in four dimensions. And if you don't pay attention to soft gravitons in the sense of finite wavelength but long wavelength gravitons, then you don't measure what comes out of the scattering experiment very carefully, including those gravitons, then you're going to lose information, right? That's not very interesting. I mean, there's lots of ways that I can make careless measurements and lose information. The question is, why is there information in the outstate in the first place, right? Hawking's calculation uses nothing but the assumption that the horizon of a large black hole is locally in the vacuum, and concludes from that, I think correctly, that the outstate should be a thermal density operator. You have to answer the question why that's wrong, right? Why is there any information in the outstate to lose in the first place? Once you have a unitary S matrix, then yes, there are a million ways you could then, you know, screw up your experiment and not get the information out anyway. And not paying attention to soft gravitons is one of them in a long, long list. But that's not very interesting. We already knew that. Right? But I would maintain that the claim that the vacuum contains information is literally made. It is also made. And that's just wrong. Yeah.
Well, you can decode the information of the vacuum. It's just noisy. So here you're considering trying to encode additional information into a signal, and the vacuum is kind of in the way because it has some noise already. It's like pumping multiple signals into.
Oh, sorry. Here we're talking about the global vacuum. So here the claim would be that the global vacuum. Is not unique,
right,
and so contains information. Like which global vacuum I dial is something that I can store information, and I could later go back and look at that and extract that information.
Right. Okay. That's something different.
Yeah.
So can you go back to your example of the Alice measuring whatever the energy of the mass in this planet? There is radiation. Bob is only checking at different times. And
yeah.
There is no information that can be extracted. I just have a couple of questions. There are also going to be tails. So there would be tails in the gravitational field. So after radiation has passed, there is infinite amount of time of radiation. You may have to have a very, very sensitive detector, but there is always radiation going on in that space-time. And also I have memory. So the gravitational wave goes through, and if I have two objects separated some distance, they will not necessarily come back to the same.
There are a lot of questions here. Okay. As far as tails go, I don't see why there have to be tails. I mean, for example, let's consider the simpler case where I'm sending out electric charge. But if you're worried about effects like that, I can simply make the naive information content arbitrarily large by, say, starting with a very large amount of charge. And there's many different messages that Alice could send by choosing how much she's going to radiate away. That's going to scale differently than whatever exponentially small amount of tails is around when Bob opens his eyes. Notice also that I can make that amount go away or make it as small as I like by Bob having Bob perform his measurement arbitrarily late. It doesn't change anything about the setup. It should still be possible to measure the conserved charge. But whatever tails there are will have died away. Now, the second part of your question, so it doesn't scale in the right way, right? So I can still get it. The second part of your question, I think, is a very important point that, again, connects with some of the claims by Hawking, Perry, and Strominger. So suppose that I have some gravitational radiation arriving during this time. At Scribe Plus, right? And what this will do, it will sort of transform you from one BMS frame into another. Right? So what you could do here is you could put a bunch of masses out at infinity on some sphere, right? And then after this gravitational radiation has passed through, these masses will have been deformed a little bit. The sphere will have been deformed, and that's the memory effect. Right? You will have measured the gravitational memory that was accumulated by this radiation. So this memory is called delta CAB, and it's really pretty much just the integral of the Bonnie news that arrived. Right? So it's just some part of the information that is encoded in this Bonnie news. And of course, there's far more information in it. Okay. So this is a measurement that you can obviously perform. Okay, if you want to perform it, your detectors need to be on between here and here. If you forgot to put any test masses here, you're out of luck. Right? Now, the fact that you get to receive information here is perfectly consistent with this bound because there's also energy arriving, quantity. You can easily check that that's more than enough to account not only for the gravitational memory, but for all other information that's encoded in the gravitational radiation that's arriving here, sort of the higher modes. Right? What you can do, but HPS frequently, at least with significant ambiguity, seem to claim you can do, right, is to not have any test masses out here that would get jiggled by this radiation, but somehow measure the vacuum at this time, just empty space, there's nothing there. Right? Then go to sleep with no test masses here receiving this radiation, then wake up the next morning and again just measure empty space. And somehow figure out from that what delta CAB is. There's no way to do that.
No, I'm not saying that, but you could have the test masses.
Yeah, but if you have the test masses there,
then I go to sleep, I don't watch it.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. I mean, whether you personally watch it or not doesn't matter. The,
right,
the point is that there's a...
ask what is its date at the end.
Sorry.
Because you said there is no information. And
no, what I said is that there's no information in the vacuum. So there is no information here or here. Right. So again, either you have information, then you also have energy. Or you don't have information, and then you don't have energy. So the, notice that this global state is not the vacuum. Right? So in particular, what I can consider, right, is just empty Minkowski space using different coordinates, different Bondi frames, labeled by CAB1, CAB2, and so on. I can't go into these spacetimes and somehow sniff around and figure out which of these it is. There's no information in that choice of coordinates.
Any other questions?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Sorry, you mentioned it's probably a very small technical detail, but when you mentioned the average energy of a message, did you mean the energy which something like the energy which Bob would receive with the message or something similar?
It's a very good question. And what I really meant was, let me just go back to the relevant slide so we can connect to that.
So the energy scale of the, okay.
So what I really mean is delta K of rho average. That packages into one thing, the thing that I sort of called energy times time. And so I'm speaking loosely when I refer to these two quantities separately. What really provides the upper bound is this delta K. And this delta K is some integral over the stress tensor that arrives. So if Bob's detectors are on from some time U1 to U2, let's call U1 zero. Then there's some function g of u times t u u. And this g u u has the property that it has slope 1 and minus 1 at the two ends of the interval. So it kind of gives you the Rindler modular Hamiltonian locally near the corners. And then it has some other shape that you can compute that depends on the theory that it interpolates and it's concave.
I was just thinking of the Masahiro Hata's energy teleportation thing, but it doesn't really seem to be relevant here.
Teleportation. Yeah, so it doesn't actually matter how you get the quantum state, Bob. The only thing that matters is how much time does Bob have and how much energy is there, or what is this integral.
So just a quick follow-up. Does this mean that gravitational signals are not included in this bound?
That's a really good question, yeah. So normally it's hard to take gravitational waves into account in sort of entropy bounds in general spacetimes. Not because of entropy bounds, but because of the fact that we don't know what we mean by gravitational waves in general spacetimes. Here, it is possible to take them into account because we are near future infinity. And so you can identify them with the Bonnie news, and you can include that. So this TUU here has a contribution in it from the energy density of the Bondi nuke. So it has some NAB squared in it. Contains that. So this, you know, plus whatever radiation is arriving from scalar fields and electromagnetic. So in this case, you can include the Bonnie news both in the information content of what's arriving and also the bound response to it, because it knows about the energy density in the Bonnie news through the contribution to the flux added.
Given this bound, does that, like, if we were to try to build a protocol to saturate this bound, does that tell us that we should encode information in the modular Hamiltonian eigenbasis? Because that's where we're comparing to thermal? I don't know, I'm just trying to find hints to engineer a protocol that would achieve this bound.
What actually, so there are many different ways to saturate this bound. One way to saturate it is actually precisely the example that I gave, where you increase the number of messages to be very, very large. So let me draw a little plot. So let me put log n on this axis. So if Bob was like Alice and could see all of space, then you know, this, and this is H AB, so this is the mutual information, then of course the mutual information would just grow like the number of messages. And now here's our entropy bound. Okay. And so what really happens is this. It actually does saturate. So there's you know, as you increase the number of signals, you actually get to get arbitrarily close to saturating. Another way to saturate it is to be very close to the vacuum. In that case, very little information is communicated, but but the upper bound is also very low, and then in the limit where you approach the vacuum, you saturate the bound.
Do you see other ways in which this is relevant for the black hole information problem? So I understand the part you said already, but do you see other ways?
I think the sort of most the sharpest version of the black hole information problem now is the firewall paradox, and so of course there are many close relations here. I mean, it's the fact that the vacuum at the horizon contains no information that makes it, by this argument, impossible for radiation to emanate from that region and get out to Rai plus. And certainly, you know, these bounds are sort of consistent with that claim. But it seems to me that firewall paradox has been too hard to attack like all at once. I mean, we've certainly tried, and I don't think there are currently any approaches that are really very promising. And I think to neither direction. I mean, what people are exploring much more is attempts to get rid of firewalls. I think that it might be worth thinking a little bit harder about sort of the absurdity of firewalls actually forming. How would that happen? What is the dynamics? And, you know, can we come up with toy models for that are not totally crazy and at least don't violate causality or something? But either way, I think it seems like, you know, that might be it might be hard to break off a piece that we can bite. And so really why I'm working on this is in fact as part of a kind of retreat to try to encircle the problem, develop new tools and get ready for, you know, a second run on it.
Yeah.
are no more questions, then let's thank Rafael again.
Thank you.